Okay, we'll get started. Hi everyone, and welcome to the final concurrent session. This afternoon session is called Till Death Do Us Part, and Alan Stevens and Nathan Benarius will be presenting. I'll just do a brief introduction into their backgrounds and then I'll let them get started. They can do a much better job of giving an introduction into what they're speaking about than I can. Alan is a senior consultant with over 40 years experience in the financial services industry in Australia and overseas, both in senior management roles and as a consultant. Alan has extensive experience in wholesale and retail markets and has managed and provided advice on product design and pricing, related systems development, marketing, advertising and distribution. He also has had significant involvement in developing and implementing corporate strategy, including restructuring, mergers and acquisitions. His wealth management experience includes life insurance, health insurance, superannuation, funds management, master trusts, lending and distribution. He's also had experience in equity and derivatives markets as a broker. And Alan's recent experience has been on specialist fund design and strategic advice for superannuation funds. Nathan Benarius is a consultant in the Market Insights team at Rice Warner. He joined Rice Warner in 2010 and is currently responsible for the production of all of Rice Warner's superannuation and life insurance research reports, such as the Superannuation Markets Projections Report. He's also responsible for the maintenance of Rice Warner's research databases, the improvement of existing products and market opportunities for new products. Nathan's also actively been involved in a range of consulting activities within superannuation, including the provision of strategic advice, assistance with mergers, outsourcing and administration tenders, risk management and actuarial valuations. Nathan qualified as a Fellow of the Institute of Actuaries in 2014. So without any further ado, I'll pass you over to Alan to get things started. Thank you.
Thanks, Kirsty. Right, now, what we'd like to talk about today, and I'll just give you a quick, see if this works. It does, beautiful. We're going to give a bit of background, that's where I'll start with, as to how we've got here, what we want to talk about. And then the basis of what we're doing here is, in fact, what Kirsty said Nathan's responsible for is our research database. We've got a lot of data, and we also have a rather large, probably call it econometric model of the Australian financial markets. And he'll spend a little bit of time talking about that, the data of the month, and then looking at some of the outcomes of that which we've just recently pulled out, particularly looking at the place of the bequests, the inheritances that are in the system. It's something that most of us, when we look at the market, things haven't done before. We haven't thought about what is this, what does it do, how much money is there, where does it go, and what does it mean for people's assets in retirement, age pensions, etc. So just to take... I went up to my earlier slide, so I'll hop over that one because I've just been talking about. We did also do the modelling work that went into the Institute white paper for Richer for Poorer, which looked at the intergenerational positions, where people are today, where they will be when they get to retirement compared to the older people who are virtually on the verge of retirement today and then moving into retirement. That did show up a couple of things. If you want the full detail, you'll have to read the paper because there's quite a lot in it. But the critical importance of the age pension, except for the, you'd probably say, the top two or three deciles of wealth, but for everybody else it's important down at the first, second, third deciles. Essentially that's their income in retirement. We do see an improvement in the position of the younger cohorts when they get to retirement in relation to their superannuation. But when we did the numbers, we could see that they weren't quite as well off in relation to housing and their private wealth. Some of that was possibly based on the way the assumption sets work within the model, but so it did beg the question, what's happening there? And in particular, when we did that modelling, that model did not have the capacity to look at intergenerational transfers. So if you consider that the 60, 65-year-olds today have already been the beneficiary of intergenerational transfers from their parents, and you look at the 30-year-olds and when they get to retirement, our modelling wasn't taking into account that the current 60-year-olds would be passing money back or assets back to that group. So we wanted to have a look at that. The other area that has brought this out is, and I've just been speaking about this in the other session, the housing wealth, which is the green paper that the Institute produced as well under Cathy Nance and Christine Brownhill's back there. And that did also, that illustrated the importance of housing, and in fact the importance of, if people wanted to live better in retirement, of actually releasing some of the value out of that housing. Now, it's almost a no-brainer. If they want to release value out of that housing, the housing's either, it's got to be transferred either by sale or by bequest to a younger generation, because there's no one else for it to go to. So the housing does need to move down the generations. and there were a number of findings in that paper. They're just some highlight points. We then, we were actually looking to get a more comprehensive paper written beforehand, but we then got caught up with our friends, the government and the Treasury and the budget. There have been a number of changes brought out that came out a couple of weeks ago. That's just a list of them. I'm not going to go through them, but significant changes to the potential changes to the structure and the movement of money through the system. So although our intention was to get a paper out before this forum, we haven't yet written the paper, so we've got the presentation of it, because there were some, in the lead up to the budget, there were a number of potential issues that could have changed it quite a lot, so we did need to wait. One in particular, there was a distinct, probably better than a rumour, that the government was considering an opt-out arrangement at the bottom end of the salary scales, so that people up to salaries up to $18,000 or something would not have to pay super at all. And that would have changed the dynamics of the market quite significantly. So what we're going to show you today is based on all of the, it considers all of the changes that were brought in as part of the budget as if they had been legislated. So if they don't all get legislated, it's a bit different, but we've made the assumption they'd be legislated. Having done all that, weighted all that, done all the work, done all the numbers, the budget actually does very little to the overall dynamics of the market, except for those in probably the top two income deciles or wealth deciles. And if you look at it structurally in the industry, really only for the SMSF sector. They're the only ones that will get materially impacted by what was brought in. So for pretty much everything else, not much has changed, despite what the commentators might be saying. So I'll now get Nathan, who, as you've heard, is the expert on all the data and the research, to talk about it.
Thank you, Alan. And the budget itself, coincidentally, was released on my birthday. So that was a nice little birthday present on for me. May 3rd, it comes out. There's all these changes. And then we've got, less than 2 weeks to put it all through our model and get the results in time for this forum. So the data. So we're looking at the issue of intergenerational transfers. A lot of the hype in the industry these days is we're always talking about big data. And indeed, Rice Warner have some large databases ourselves. We collect about 11 million superannuation statement records annually. And there's a lot of challenges that come across with that in terms of having the right systems, computing power to actually process that data. And the skills necessary to query and extract value and even to know where to look. But relative to the problem of bequests, the problem of big data is actually a really nice problem to have. When it comes to looking for information on bequests, it's really an example where I think actuaries add a lot of value working with scarce data. There's not really a lot of information on the topic, but somehow, through working through what we do know and what we're able to model, hopefully we've been able to produce something that gives us some sensible and useful outputs. So when we've modelled the intergenerational transfers, we're talking about all transfers of assets on death. So I'm going to deal with the easy one first, which is transfers to spouses. Because unless you really don't like your spouse, it's likely that most of the assets are going to go there. So essentially, to start off with, we've looked at the deaths that our group model produces, and I'll talk a little bit more about the structure and the assumptions behind that model a little later. But at the start, we've just taken marriage rates from the ABS and we've assumed that the proportion of benefits going to spouses follow that distribution of marriage rates by age and gender. Then what we've done is we've estimated what the average spouse characteristics are based off the ABS Survey of Income and Housing microdata. And when doing that, we've looked at what does my average spouse look like in terms of age and the income quantile that they are in, and we've allocated the assets accordingly. So there's a pretty little graph on rates of marriage by age and gender, and unsurprisingly, the males are married for a lot longer, mostly because they're all dying off first, lucky us. But then the question is, what happens with the rest of the money? And this is where we start to encounter difficulties in terms of what should we use, what data source can we use to populate our assumptions? And as far as we can tell, there's not really any government data that's publicly available which tells us anything about transfers of wealth to dependents. There's very few longitudinal studies that have looked at this issue at all. And when you read through a lot of the academic literature on this topic, the same data source pops up time and time again, and that's the Housing Income and Labour Dynamics Survey, or HILDA. And for those of you who aren't familiar with HILDA, it's a longitudinal survey of households. It's got population weights. I think there's about 16,000 individuals in the sample overall, which isn't very big. And they ask questions on wealth every 4 years. So it's not the most comprehensive, detailed study, especially when you start to cut down that sample of 16,000 people over a decade or so, and just look at the question they ask on inheritances and bequests. Once you look at that, you've only got less than 2,000 records to play with. So not a lot of fun. And it only asks, did you receive it? And if you received one, how much was it? So we don't know where they received the money from. Was it from a spouse? Was it from a mother? Was it from a father, a grandparent? And we don't know if it was shared with anyone else. So you know, for me, I'm one of five, so I get to look forward splitting through any money that my parents leave over with four other people. Only if they're alive. He's giving me some nefarious ideas. We don't know a lot of information about... We don't even know what form those assets took. Was it housing assets? Was it private wealth? Was it superannuation? No idea. And the average values that we see in this sample are also low. And it's hard to say exactly... Well, they appear low. I shouldn't say they are low. Maybe that's exactly the value that people receive. But they just seem low when you think about kind of median house prices and assets that other people have in private wealth. And you look at what should be kind of coming out of the system and then what they're receiving. They appear low intuitively to me. So here's our analysis of the profile of the people who are receiving that bequest money based on the HILDA data. And you can see that the distribution really peaks between 55 and 64, so the lead up right to retirement. So you can infer from that a lot of people will be able to use these assets to boost their superannuation balances or their private wealth balances and actually consume those assets in retirement. And indeed, just personally, my mother inherited some money last year from her parents and put in the full $180,000 non-concessional. And in light of the government's changes, maybe she should have put in a little bit more. But when you look at the average value of those bequests, they kind of, again, they go up with age, and they peak at around $100,000. Other analysis, there's the Grattan Report, Wealth of Generations, which really was a report that was trying to look into the financial position of different cohorts or generations in terms of their wealth and income. And the conclusion out of that report was that we're getting ripped off. Alan disagrees, and he can talk to you about that separately if you like, but because it's me, I'm going to just agree with it and say that all you oldies are ripping us off. But in terms of the data they use to actually estimate bequests in that report is the exact same source. It's HILDA data once again, so it's reasonably consistent with what we're seeing. The next question we had was, what do actually people do when they receive an inheritance? Because we need to know when we're doing the modelling, projecting forward, are they just blowing it all? Are they spending it, you know, taking the kids on a trip overseas, gambling it, or are they saving it? And again, very little information here. One of our analysts did track down a paper, and it's based on a US study, do people spend or save their inheritances? And from that, we've come up with a very rough and ready assumption, 45%. You can argue whether that should be different by the income quantiles or the wealth they already have or their age, but the reality is there's really no data here for us to play with. So 45% is an assumption. It might not be as good as other assumptions, but it probably won't be much worse either. So that's the data we have to go with when we're modelling bequests. Now I'm going to talk very briefly about the structure of our actual model, and then from there, Alan and I can then walk you through some of the results. So our model is based off the model that we use for our superannuation market projections report, which we've updated annually. But in the last year and a half, we actually partnered with Industry Super Australia and have been enhancing that model and extending it. So initially we were doing the superannuation industry and we were projecting it forward 15, 30 years. Now we've extended that to private wealth, housing assets. We're modelling age pension, tax expenditures, and we can go a full 80 years forward into the future. It's a very complicated model. If we run it for just 40 years, it produces 86 million rows of output in a database that we then have to analyse, and that will take approximately an hour to run, unless I try to do it on my laptop, in which case we might be waiting for 100 years. In terms of the model structure, we're projecting individual ages. We've got it split by gender. We also do it by the industry sector, so corporate funds, public sector, retail, industry, SMSFs. And we've also quantiled the members by their income plus deemed income off the back of wealth. And that's based on the Survey of Income and Housing microdata.
And part of the reason for that is to make sure when we talk about wealth, people who are asset rich and people who are income rich aren't called wealthy.
That's right. We also model accounts as well as members, and we model them by phase. So we know who's actively contributing to their super, who's inactive, who's transitioning to retirement, and who is retired. So the model uses a ton of data from all over the place, mostly APRA, ATO, ABS statistics. In particular, we're using the ABS population projections, Series B, which is the midpoint one. We use participation rates based on some work by the Productivity Commission, and I've mentioned the Survey of Income and Housing. One last data source we have is we actually collect member statement records from a large number of major superannuation funds. The last time we did it, we had 24 funds, and we received about 10.8 million member records. So that's everything from demographics, transactions, insurance, investments, and exits. So we know where they're going, when they're retiring, how much they're taking with them, and what they do with it. So that's really a useful data set in terms of populating a lot of our assumptions around what people do with their money at retirement, how they contribute, how that varies by age and income and gender and things like that. So here are some key assumptions. Wage inflation 4%, CPI 3%. We do a survey of the asset consultants as well, and that kind of populates our investment asset class returns. So Alan mentioned the For Richer, For Poorer paper at the start of this session, and I will flag right off that this is a different model to what we used for that. When we did For Richer, For Poorer, we were doing cameo projections, individuals. This is a group model. This model is a lot more complicated and sophisticated in many ways. Although when you're looking at cameo results, they're not too different. But don't expect the results that we show you on these slides to match what's in that paper if you go back and compare later. I mean, there's differences in the quantiling structure that we've used. And in For Richer, For Poorer, we assumed when we did couples analysis that spouses were of equal age and wealth, and we didn't have any intergenerational transfers. And already I've mentioned to you that for this new model, we're looking at average spouse characteristics, and we are including intergenerational transfers. The other thing we've done is obviously in between that paper and now, we've had a year's worth of new data that we've incorporated into the model. So our general approach to modelling the bequests, essentially, someone dies. If they're married, or the proportion that are married, well, your money goes straight to your spouse, 100%. That's the assumption. If you're single...
Are you just using legally married there or married...
Whatever the ABS calls married.
Yep, that's right. And then if you're single, then a portion of the money will be consumed, holidays, bequests, to charities, spending on other things, and that's the 45-65, and the rest will be saved. And it will all go into either private wealth or housing. We haven't put any of it back into superannuation. Okay, and so, yeah, so we've assumed married people give it exclusively to their spouse. Proportion of non-spousal inheritances is constant, and the current trends in terms of that are going to continue into the future. All right, so just an aside, a little note before we get into the results. We're not considering any additional assets that the member might have received and then passed on as the result of insurance. And then another quick note on double counting. So where possible, we want to avoid double counting of these assets, but of course, sometimes that will be impossible. So, for example, we normalise our projection of superannuation contributions against current contribution trends and statistics. When you look at APRA or our own proprietary data, and you're looking at what money is coming in to superannuation, for example, as a non-concessional contribution, we have no reliable statistics to tell us what the source of that money was. So there is a chance that in some cases people would have received a bequest, like my mother, put the money into super, and we might be counting it twice because it'll be included in our contribution assumptions and in our inheritance bequest assumptions. But we imagine that the impact of that will be generally quite small. And now for the exciting bit, the results.
Click it on. Okay. Get to do the cute bit. So this was just to look, obviously there's money, we want to talk about the money, but money is based on people. And that just gives you an indication, there's the lines of the rates of mortality, but the bars show you that the numbers of people on the right-hand scale that generate a bequest or capable of generating a bequest each year by age. And as you'd expect, the bulk of them are aged over 75. If we then take that and look at the flows through the market, and as Nathan said, we look at the death rates within each of these quantiles, we see a flow something like this. So this is in 2015 dollars, discounted at wages. And you can see it at the moment, there's something of the order of $50 to $60 billion being passed on in bequests. And because simply of the growth in the asset pools, based on, you know, obviously there's the assumptions of contributions, et cetera, even in real terms, that moves up over that period to 2050. Something of that in that order. So becomes quite substantial sums of money in dollar terms, although if you look at it as a percentage of the asset pool, the asset pools are also driving up at the same rate. So if we look at total system assets, now this one is just done in, this is not discounted assets, it's in. So you can actually see you're ending up with, out of that period, in nominal terms, $50 or $60 trillion worth of total assets. That's across the three sectors, which is quite a lot. But the impact of the bequests is the difference between the red and the white line. So essentially, we ran the model and said all of the bequest money just disappears, gets chucked away. And that's the green line. And then on the other hand, as Nathan explained, we assume that that money is then passed on to the spouses or the succeeding generations. And overall, it makes something of the order of about 6.87% difference over that period to the total assets in the system. And if we then reflect that back, because one of the reasons we want to look at this is what might the error factor be in when we're estimating the age pension. If we move it over to and look at the age pension outlays, they obviously go down here, and it's a similar percentage reduction in the age pension. Just as an aside, if you take this and look forward into the, if you recall last year, beginning of last year, there was the intergenerational report, which suggested that age pension outlays would rise from about 2.9% of GDP up to about 4.3%. The simple answer is the intergenerational report is actually quite significantly wrong. The age pension outlay.
A separate session on that too.
And there's a separate session on that, yeah. It's significantly wrong. And it grossly overestimates the pension outlays. So our best estimate is that the pension outlays at worst will stay at about their current level of GDP over that period. Now, if we look at... That's okay, that's the system. What does it mean for the people, the individuals? And these, we've deliberately made them look a bit like... What was put in the For Richer For Poorer report. So we've got the 25th percentile wealth, median, and 75th percentile up here, and we've looked at the two cohorts: a young cohort, 30 years old, and an older cohort, 60 years old, at their point of retirement. So, and the point of retirement is at age 67. For the purposes of this calculation. And the red, blue and green shows you what they'd get essentially without any inheritance, and then the little dotted bars at the top show you what the total would be if you took the inheritances into account. And I know someone's going to ask the question, so we will have the discussion later as to these numbers here, which are different, obviously. The higher wealth ones have less, but we'll talk about that later. That's for a woman. And there's another one for a man. For a man, they all look about the same height, but please notice that the scale on the left has gone up by 50%. And you get a similar... the interesting thing is the men there tend to get a bit less, which is probably because the men are dying first and the men are inheriting from women who have less money. So that's that type of effect at the older ages anyway. So the bequests are not making significant changes to the totals. But as we saw overall, even on the system level, it's about 7%. Here it looks a little bit lower than that, but you look at these individual groups. We've left out the very high wealth deciles, and at the very high wealth deciles, that's where you do get much higher levels of bequest coming through. What does this do for their pension entitlements or their income in retirement? And that's the last two slides we want to do is look at women and men. The interesting point being is that, like here and here, the bequest actually causes the income in retirement to go down because essentially from the model we say if they've got a certain amount of assets, they draw it down at a certain rate. So now they'll have slightly more assets, so the amount they draw down will be slightly higher. But because they've got more assets and a very sharp taper on the means test, they actually lose more age pension than they get back in, than they get from the extra assets that they're drawing down. Obviously, they could choose to draw down a little bit more, but this is just to keep everything consistent. But probably best to say it's overall here in these groups not having much of an impact, except down at the younger ages there. And similarly for the men, there's pretty much very little impact on the total income across the board. Now, again, part of this is that's based on what we've modelled, so one of the questions we will be facing is now that we've discovered that it doesn't seem to do very much based on the current set of assumptions, are they as good as they could be, and can we do some things to make them a bit better?
That's based on minimum drawdown.
No.
So our superannuation insights database, we've got the 11 million records, we've got pension records as well. Now we're looking at the ATO and the APRA statistics. So we've used drawdown rates by age and gender, which are roughly equivalent to those, but subject to the minimum. But what you find is that on average everyone draws more than the minimum because that's the way it has to be.
Yeah, some people draw the minimum, some draw a bit more, so on average they're a bit higher than the minimum. And it does vary by age, and not just because the minimum varies by age, but it's essentially our best estimate based on current drawdown rates across the industry, because the 11 million records is about, what, it's about 40% of all, we've got about 40% of all super records. So. And I did want to add, we know everything about what they're doing except a couple of pieces of information. We don't know where they live, we don't know what their phone number is, and we don't know what their names are. So that's the overall outcome. And now, if you want to ask any more questions, and I can put some slides back if you want me to backwards and forwards them to ask the questions.
Thanks, Alan and Nathan. I just ask that if you have any questions, if you could please come to the microphone in the middle and identify yourself.
Paul Shalhoub. Thanks very much for the presentation. To build on the previous question about the assumption of the drawdown rates, presumably the change in the pension means tests will have an impact on those drawdown rates. How to build that in, I'm not sure, but I guess what you're doing is basing the drawdown rates on a different pension means test from what you're predicting.
Yeah, that's right. It probably will have an impact. At the moment, our drawdown assumptions don't vary with the projection year. You certainly could try to build it in, but then you've got to do a little bit of thumb-sucking and guesswork as to what impact that will have. In our other model, the Cameo model, which we use for the For Richer For Poorer, we have a couple of options in terms of how members draw down. So we can use drawdown rates based on actuals. Another method sometimes that we use is either the minimum drawdown or 1 over life expectancy. And then a third option which we use sometimes is to optimise the drawdown so that you receive the most income that you can until life expectancy.
And that's what we did for which we used that fund method. Because systemically it's the right number.
Yeah. The problem with that number is if you use that method, you will get numbers like what Treasury got in the IGR for age pension outlays. Because essentially everyone runs out of assets by the time they hit life expectancy and then all go on to a full-age pension. And we have pretty good reason to believe, after talking to some people at Treasury, that that is what they have assumed. And that's why the age pension rises significantly, because one of our models, we turned the assumption on and off, and we almost got exactly the same number as them.
Christine, I'm very good with older people. Your idea that spouses inherit, I think, is very interesting, but I do not see it. The family law act came in 1976, so a lot of the marriages were over, and whilst we have a new relationship, we don't leave the money to the new spouse. We leave it on to the kids or to somebody else. My money is mine, your money is yours. So it's not my spouse gets it. Also, I have quite a lot of clients, and when the spouse has got dementia, they're out of the will. So that it goes somewhere else, it doesn't go to the dementia's army. So I think your percentage marriage, if you're saying married as per the census, because people might write married when actually they forgot about the bit of paper and it's this partner this year and might have had this one for a few years, but still, I'm not sticking with this one forever. And secondly, they're keeping their assets separate, so their income separate. So I would doubt your percentage is marriage. And I'd love to see what would happen if you said in even half that so-called marriage, the spouse did not inherit. The spouse got a lot of interest in the house, at best, and everything else went on to the kids or to somebody or other else. That would be my vision of reality. We just don't share equal generations.
No, that's a... Thank you, that's a very good point. I mean, to the extent there's a life interest, the way this model would it's sort of doing that, because the person has it, and then they, as soon as they die, they give it on. So the life interest movement would work in the right way. But the other ones, I agree with you. We've overemphasised what's then going to the spouse.
And his kids get his and her kids get hers.
Yeah.
We
don't share. Our problem is figuring out whose kids are whose. as Nathan said, the data there is so vague anyway, so it's very, very difficult. So we just say some kids get money.
Yeah, that's the issue. We don't know the source of any inheritance in the Hildedale.
I asked them.
You asked them? They still haven't done it.
They'll tell me what they've done. What they do.
I'm wondering whether you have any feel for whether... Given the outcome that in a lot of cases the bequest that went into super didn't seem to generate any extra income, whether that's become an eternal bequest, is that then being left to the following generation where it'll do the same thing, or have you got any feel for that sort of outcome?
Well, no, I think if you saw there, what we've modelled is any... So if someone dies, they've got a super account. That super account, we assume, moves to the beneficiaries as defined and is put outside the super system and put into private wealth. Any private wealth goes to private wealth, and any housing goes to housing. So we've not tried to complicate. So the private wealth then going into super. And that's the point Nathan made about the possible double count, because we've got a normalised set of... contributions data going into the super system. Now, some of those contributions may well actually be non-concessional contributions based on bequests. So to that extent, there's a potential as a bit of double counting here, but we've essentially kept benefit payments or asset values transferred on death out of the super fund. They go into private wealth.
And the other thing I think to keep in mind as well is this is a group model. So everything you see with the... results by age and income quantile and gender is an average of what occurs, whereas in fact, in reality, a bequest is a binary outcome. Either you received one or you didn't. So once you start averaging it, the values get quite a bit lower. So those numbers that you're seeing are saying, all right, well, you know, you've got an extra 30,000-40,000 in assets, where in reality, the person who receives it might have an extra 100,000.
And the other one got nothing.
That's right. So they might be able to generate more income off the back of that. The problem is, when we're assuming the drawdowns, we've got, I think, for private wealth, for people of that age, they're drawing down about 5%. Now, if you got $1,000 extra, 5%, $50, the means testing by that stage will be $3 times 26 fortnights, so $75. Everyone's going to end up with more income when they're receiving less income because of that when they're receiving the age pension.
Does that mean we've effectively got 100% inheritance tax already?
Well, to the extent that it's been passed on to someone else who's eligible for the age pension, it's passed down to the next younger generation. Ultimately, they might.
Of course, they can still choose to consume that capital if they wish and then get the age pension anyway. So maybe the message is you should probably take a holiday.
there. So if it's on the fringe, it's probably better. You actually better be spending it. If it's a decent sum, you might want to keep it and draw down. Yeah.
Okay, we're just about out of time. I guess I have one final question. I don't work in this particular area, but I'm always interested in data. And the start of the session, Nathan, you spoke a bit about there being lack of data. So what do you think you would like to see this industry do to try and address that? And then what value do you think it would add?
Well, I guess it would be good if we could get more data. So you've mentioned that you've asked Hilda to tell you the source of...
I asked the real people.
Oh, the real people. Okay. But it would be good if people like Hilda did start to collect it. It would be good if the ABS could publish information on this by collecting information of what happens with assets on death. I'm not sure whether there's any... other government departments that would be more appropriate. I mean,
we could talk to Treasury about reinstituting the inheritance tax, and then I'll keep the stuff.
I guess the other thing is, you know, if someone was doing some research, there was one study that we'd looked at. I think it was a New Zealand study where they'd actually gone and sampled wills. And gone and talked to lawyers and got information of what's actually happening with the money there. And if you could do a study like that on a large scale in Australia, then you could get some really useful data out of that, which would really help us in terms of assumption setting here and producing a model that gives really good outcomes for the government.
Okay, so we're out of time. Thanks, everyone, for your questions. If I can just ask you to try and remember to fill in your feedback forms before you leave, and also to thank Alan and Nathan for such an interesting presentation.